bonds of friendship.
Let's go back a little bit to the story of what is going on in Egypt. What is Tahrir Square? And what is the importance of that particular square in terms of politics, say, prior to January 2011?
So prior to 2011, there had been demonstrations there before, but I grew up with Tahrir being, you know, more a traffic roundabout. However, it's a very central part of Cairo because you have, on one side, you have the Arab League. On another side, you have the Egyptian Museum. On another side, you have the Mugamma, which is the main building where everybody gets everything bureaucratic done. If you need any kind of paperwork, your passport done, anything, you have to go to this building. American University on another side, the Nile on another side. And so it really is a center where if it's blocked and if people can't go through, it stops a lot of what's happening in the city, at least. There's a lot of media around this area in downtown Cairo. So it's a place where a lot of media can constantly get to and film. So in a way, in those first 18 days, a lot of the people were protected because where there were international news cameras on them constantly. And that's really where witness is so important in these kinds of struggles because, you know, if you know that anything that you do is going to be on national television, then, you know, you're a little bit more careful about what you do.
And when you got there, it was already being occupied by people. That was before Occupy Wall Street, right?
Yeah. Occupy Wall Street did not happen until, I think, September of 2011. It had been occupied for about 4 or 5 days by the time I got there.
But the Occupy movement was inspired in many ways by Tahrir. And we remember in Egypt when it started, it was amazing to see that people in America, where, you know, we look at as kind of have had much more experience in the democratic process than we have, were looking at our success and failures. You know, that what was happening in that square was much more of a world issue, and that was there was the local issues of Egypt, but then there was a kind of a rise in people power that was starting to bubble.
Karim Amir, producer of this film, The Square, you were in the square as well at that particular time?
You know, I was in the square. I'm Egyptian, American. I grew up between both countries. I went down to the square. I was living in Egypt at the time, and I went down as a skeptic, to be honest, because I had participated in political protests in the United States against the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, and I hadn't seen anything come out of it. If nothing came out of it in America, where you have this tradition of popular protest and you have this legacy of the 1960s, then nothing's going to happen in Egypt. And I'm really happy that I was wrong. Egyptians had reached a point, or enough Egyptians had reached a point where they said, that's it. They drew a line in the sand. And I think that that was an exhilarating moment, and it just changed the world of possibility for all of us. You're talking about a country where people don't have basic political rights, civil rights, or even kind of, we didn't have a feeling that we could make any change or we could affect any change, so that there was no sense of agency, you know, among everyday citizens. And what happened in that square was that break. It was the fear barrier was broken for the first time, and when it fell, there was no turning back. And that's what this protest movement has been successful in accomplishing, regardless of the results on the political continuum that we find today. It has created is a shift in consciousness among many Egyptians, and it created a feeling of agency that for the first time in the land of the pharaohs, you know, everyday Egyptians felt that they could now be authors of the future, be authors of their own lives. And that was a big step.
Jahan Nujaim, you go into the square now. You have these people with video cameras. Are you thinking this is a film? What's going through your mind? This is a short subject. You don't even know what's going to happen at the end of 18 days. Maybe everybody will be killed.
That's true. You don't know what's going to happen. And I didn't know. I knew I wanted to make a film because when you feel that energy, you know that you want to share it with the world. And you know you're at the beginnings of something. Although when Mubarak stepped down and there are these huge celebrations and this climax, it becomes, well, is the story over? And how do you begin a film really with a climax? And so What happened was I started to look for characters because I know that that is how you can make a story that will touch the hearts and minds of people far away from Egypt, millions of miles away from the square. If you make a very human story that is about a person and their dreams and their aspirations, that is a story people can relate to.
The personal becomes the general.
There you go. So the more deeply specific and personal you make it, the more of the bigger reach and the more reach it will have, I believe. So we started looking for characters. We met them really in those first 18 days before Mubarak stepped down, and we started following them. And what happened was when Mubarak stepped down, about 3 weeks later, everybody cleared the square. All the international news cameras moved to other places. You know, Mubarak had stepped down. There was this fairy tale that the entire country had changed with the leaving of this president. But the fact was the rest of his government was still in place, secret police were still in place, the army was still running things. And so people came back to that square a couple weeks later and were brutally cleared away by the army. And one person who we had been following, Rami Assam, was taken to the Egyptian Museum and brutally tortured. This was a guy that had previously been standing on stage, turning the chants of the revolution into songs of the revolution. He was a hero, and yet nobody covered this story. And so we knew that we were following something at that point in time that was really important to follow. We didn't know where it was going. We just knew that we had to follow this story because it wasn't being covered anywhere.
Karim Amir, were you involved at that point?
Everybody who was there was trying to see how they could help the movement continue. And since there was no kind of leader or organizational base structure steering it, it was kind of happening in separate clusters. And so, you know, me and my cousin, we started trying to create discourse because we felt that what was going to be a big problem in Egypt is that here you had gone from having no voice to all of a sudden everyone realizing the power of their voice. Yet we hadn't created that culture of discourse. And the fear was, how do you go from a kind of law of the jungle to a win-win scenario where people feel that it's not about who's right or wrong, it's about each of us agreeing that we have the right to have that opinion. So what we did is we set up a stage in Tahrir. And there was at the time a brotherhood stage, and then there was a stage that was been set up by the leftist parties, and then we had a stage that was just, you know, kind of like an open mic stage where anybody could come up and just speak what they wanted for 5 minutes, and you spoke to the entire square.
So I thought he would be an interesting character.
Started filming from the stage first because there was a lot of interesting action happening there, because what was amazing is that most people would end up reading poetry. So there's this beautiful poetry that was being read and music being performed, and so she started filming.
And I also thought it was interesting what he was trying to do, because at some point the square was going to end, and then how do you continue these debates, and where is that center for conversation and disagreement between different groups, but as he was saying, respect for that disagreement. And so he was researching sort of where this could move to. Anyway, so I started following him, and I don't know, like after a week or two, he sort of looked at me and was like, you know, I don't know if I want to be a character in the film, but you definitely need a producer, seeing how this whole thing is organized. So he became the producer. And that's really how the whole team came together. I mean, we met our DP in the square as well, because he saw how we were using the cameras. He said, your white balance is off, your shutter speed is all wrong, and you need somebody to teach you how to use the camera. And there in the tents, he taught us how to use the cameras.
How many people were actually being followed? At the beginning, Karim was being followed. I would gather Ida was being followed. Khalid was being followed. Ahmed was being followed.
We started with about 8 characters, and we followed 4 women to begin with. We followed Ida. We followed Raji Omran, who is a human rights lawyer who I've known since kindergarten. We followed Bothaina Kamel, who ran for president at a certain point in time. She was the only woman running for president. And we followed Dina, who was a young student. What happened really was women played such an important role in this revolution. And I, as a woman, I felt it was very important that they featured prominently in this film. But at a certain point, we had to make a decision of, you know, we're making a film about this square, it's called The Square, and about people using this piece of land, public land, as a political tool for change, which was happening all around the world. These were the 3 guys that really stayed in that square, whereas Rajia was, her story is more about the legal system and the battle that she was going through with it. Bothaina left and went all around the world running for president, which is a fascinating story, and we continued to film, but it wasn't this story.
Of course, in a Verite documentary, you know, it is always difficult to find characters because their story is going to evolve as you begin following them. In this context, it's particularly difficult, I think, because there's no timeline to the story. So not only do you not know what your characters are going to do, but the square, you don't know what's happening. It's not like there's an election you're following or a process you're following. And so it's very challenging because a lot of the times the protesters who are characters were just sitting in the square. So there's really not that much going on in terms of like narrative development, you know? And when you see the film, of course, it looks like everything was happening all at the same time, but there was a lot of waiting around.
You're listening to a discussion with Jahan Nujaim, who is the director, and Kareem Amir, who is the producer of a film titled The Square, which can be seen on Netflix. It's been nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Film. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Jahan Nujaim, you're filming this, you're sitting around waiting, and there's a certain point you're following these people. You have no idea where it's going. You have no idea what's going on. You're just sitting there following it. Mubarak, who had been president of Egypt for, 30 years, is overthrown. The army takes over. And then something happens that we in America didn't understand, which is there's an election. Somehow the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamists, had gotten in bed with the army, and now there were only two people running, a Mubarak government official and the Muslim Brotherhood, and that left the people out in the cold.
What's interesting is when you make a film like this, you're really making it to try to put people in the shoes and in the perspective of the characters that you're following. And we were making this about a street fight. We were not making this about, you know, the higher levels of government and what deals were being made. So, you know, Megdi and Khalid and Ahmed, the main characters, talk about this deal with the army. Later, we felt, you know, we kept asking, what is this deal with the army, you know? And later on, somebody said, well, they ensured that the army would not be put in jail, da, da, da. But the point of the film and showing that was that this is what the conversation was on the street.
In terms of the election, I think it's important to note on this point, you know, viewing democratic transition purely on the electoral process and not on all the other factors that a democracy requires. It's a problem that we find from the American perspective. When you see a lot of the American perspective in so many countries, when it comes in, there's this idea of like, you know, throw in the election and then everything's going to be fine. But if we look at the Middle East, with American intervention in the past 15 years, with Iraq, with Afghanistan, with so many other countries, elections haven't necessarily been the indicators of democracy like we want them to be. And I think that that's what our characters were really trying to fight to achieve. They were trying to say that what's happening in Egypt is not a transition period, it's a building period, it's a founding period. And during a founding period, you're setting the infrastructure for years to come. So we cannot compromise on these basic ideals. We cannot just have an election before we write what are the rules of the game. We need a constitution first. We need to set the parameters of what this democracy will look like, and then we can elect the powers that be.
And that was the biggest issue, the fact that we had elections before a constitution, because then whoever was elected was going to write the constitution.
Which was Morsi, and the constitution he chose was this Islamist constitution.
And there was an outrage, especially because people felt, you know, here was our first taste of democracy, and the guy we bring in is doing the same exact thing as the dictator. Well, what's the point of this democracy then? You know, another thing people didn't realize in the U.S. is that when you don't have the tools of a democratic state, when you can't impeach a president, when you don't have a fair judiciary, when you don't have rule of law governing society, the street becomes your only way. So people coming down in the millions in Egypt is now how we measure sovereignty. And, you know, while that's not sustainable, that's where we're currently at. We've become very good at removing what we don't want. And hopefully we'll get better at finding what we do want.
Jahan Nujaim, in this period, Morsi is in there. You guys are thinking, do we have a film? If we do have a film, what is this film? And you're still filming with this big question mark. And at the same time, you're getting hours and hours and hours of footage. Is that correct?
Well, what happened actually, I mean, first of all, we were getting hours and hours of footage because everybody that worked on this film was sort of an activist and participant first. Everybody was a stakeholder, and I think many people were there with cameras and filming as witnesses. So our footage was used in court cases, for news stations, and not only following the character. So we ended up with a lot of footage. What happened was the first time that this roller coaster ride of a film allowed us to end it was when Morsi was elected. And that seemed like a logical ending because it was the political continuum from the bringing down of a dictator to the election of a president. However, we finished that film. We were on our way to Sundance to launch it in the United States. And all of our characters in December of 2012 were back in the streets again because Morsi had declared dictatorial powers and powers of the pharaoh, and so people were back in the streets protesting again. And we realized that it became a much more complex and interesting story and a deeper story because it became about the fight to hold government accountable. And so we decided we had to continue shooting. So we showed the film, and then we basically went back and filmed more of what was happening, which was the lead up, really, to the protests against Morsi began to build and ended up in this June 30th outpouring of people. There were large numbers of people that went down. I mean, I don't know what exactly, Kareem, do you know what the numbers were?
I mean, there's so many different numbers that people speculate.
Yeah, it's very difficult to measure.
I mean, a lot of people said around 20 million people came down around the country. And in a country of 80 million to 85 million, I mean, that's over a quarter of the country. That's a lot of people. And I think that that's the process that Egypt's going through where Egyptians are starting to figure out the way forward. And it is a difficult process. It is a few steps forward and a few steps backwards. But I think that many change movements oftentimes are like that.
Jahan Najem, this is the end of the film when finally, once again, we see, you know, Ahmed go, yes, the revolution goes on, you know, the revolution 2.0 now.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's exactly the end because I think the feeling that you get at the end, and not to spoil the ending for everybody, but, you know, there are these massive celebrations. But you then see Megdi, who is in a different location at the Brotherhood sit-in, and you witness a phone call between Ahmed and Megdi where Megdi says that the Brotherhood sit-in has been attacked, which basically points to what's about to happen in the future. And Ahmed says to him, Ahmed has just been elated that Morsi has been overthrown, yet he then talks to Megdi and says, it's what I worried about. It's the fact that we were going to start killing each other, that the people on the bottom are going to die while the leaders on top, you know, are fighting. And so it does point at the end of the film to the direction that we are going in. However, what is, I think, for us, an optimistic ending of the film is the fact that despite these political divides, you have two people, Megdi and Ahmed, who are divided politically, yet have a deep love and caring for one another. And when we've screened the film in different audiences here, where there are Egyptians in the audience, many have come up to us afterwards and said, I've got to show this to my family, because there are many Egyptian families that have families that are completely divided in their loyalties towards these different sides. And in the end, what we need to remember is what this fight was about and that we need to get to a place of pluralism. That's the struggle that we're going through in Egypt right now.
Jahan Najem, there is a quick card at the end saying that Magdi is taken away from the demonstration. I hope he's okay.
He is okay now, although he is in a difficult financial situation. He has 5 kids to feed, and he has been called in by state security, although he hasn't gone in. We do hope that a film like this offers some kind of protection. We were just on a big talk show in Egypt where a film critic at a time, a very, you know, established film critic at a time when the Brotherhood is being persecuted and has become illegal, this well-known film critic says, you know, this character in this film is a human being that was conflicted and that was trying to figure out the best thing for himself and his family. And that's a really important message to be giving right now at this time when the country is so deeply divided.
You bring it back to Sundance 2013. How does Netflix get involved in this?
So Netflix didn't get involved really until Toronto. We went back and we filmed. So we won the audience award at Sundance. So it was a difficult decision to actually show at Sundance, because even though it's a dream festival, it's where I've opened all my films, I love the festival, we knew that the story was continuing. To ask journalists and different people to see a film twice, you know, when you know that you're going to show it and then continue. You know, it was a hard decision, but we showed it there. We won an audience award, and that was such an important award. All of our crew had been really working on Fumes for 2 years, and to hear that people halfway across the world cared about the story and that it was touching people was very important and allowed us to continue. So we continued filming, editing, brought on Pedro Cos, who is a fantastic editor who's made some wonderful films. We restructured the film because you can't just add an ending. If you're going on a different place, you really have to restructure it. The film is restructured. It's really led by one character more than the others, which is Ahmed. And we basically take it and release it at Toronto.
When we showed the film in Toronto, the response was fantastic. And we won the audience award there as well. And then Netflix came on board at Toronto. We had other options, but we felt that what Netflix was offering with such a global distribution plan now with their footprint and with a very affordable price in comparison to a lot of the other distributors, cable distributors, for example, and pay TV operators, it seemed like the right fit. I'll never forget one of our executive producers, Jody Evans, who is founder of Code Pink, was like, you know, most of my activist friends don't have HBO or cable. So not to say what you should do, but, you know, think about it that way.
One final question. The square now, is it occupied? Is it empty? What's going on right now?
The square is, being spread around and, you know, ripped offline and spread and copied and all over the place. But the actual physical square right now is blocked off. It's a very dark moment, and it's a time when this conversation is so crucial to be had, and it needs to be had, and it needs to be allowed to be had. And so this is where we feel so strongly about this film getting out in Egypt, and why the international support of the film has been so important. And even though there's going to be a lot of criticism by different sort of groups, all the different sides, army, brotherhood, police, I guess if you're sort of criticized by everybody, maybe you're doing something right, you know.
But it's reflective of what the film's about, which is, you know,
it's a battle of the narrative, exactly. You know, and the sort of everyday regular people that are watching it are writing to us the most incredibly beautiful things about how this has renewed their hope in the Egyptian people and the struggle, and that it continues. And that's what's so important right now. It's very frustrating when I hear journalists say, well, has Egypt failed now that the military is back in? No, there's been a genie that has been let out of a bottle, and we feel that this film is a part of that. We hope that by opening these conversations again and allowing these conversations to happen through this film, you know, that helps this process in some small way.
You've been listening to an interview with Jahan Nujaim, who is the director of The Square. Karim Amir is the producer of The Square, and you can find The Square on Netflix. Just go looking for it. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com, where you'll also find an extended version of this interview. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle production Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at the Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at the Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.fm under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is now 12 o'clock of the noontide. 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. Oh, yeah. Good stuff, baby. Coming up soon, we have Moving On with your host, Lori Sonnenfeld, and looks like there's going to be some live music, too. So don't want to miss that. Stick around. Keep it locked right here. KBOO Portland, 90.7. Right now, let's check out the headline news at noon.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, March 21st. I'm Kristen Yount. Gunmen killed 9 and injured 6 in Kabul, Afghanistan at the Serena Hotel. The 4 armed men murdered an Afghani journalist and most of his family in a restaurant packed with people celebrating Persian New Year or Nowruz. The perception of safety in the luxury hotel made it an appealing target for the Taliban. The killers hid small arms in their socks and shoes. Taliban spokesperson Zabihullah Mujahid boasted that the Taliban could attack any place they choose. People entering the hotel are required to step through metal detectors and have their belongings x-rayed. Violence against foreigners in the region is on the rise. The point may be to create chaos that will disrupt upcoming elections. After a 3-hour standoff, all 4 gunmen were killed. A separate bombing in Kandahar during a Nowruz gathering killed 2 police and seriously wounded a member of the provincial media. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan tried to use a court order to stop Twitter transmissions from going out in Turkey today. Erdogan, angered by certain posts of audio files that depicted him or someone who sounds like him doing things that point to corruption in his administration, acquired a court order to censor Twitter within the Domain Name System, or DNS, in Turkey. Many Turks were able to get around the censors, including Turkish President Abdullah Gül, who spoke out against the censorship. Twitter administrators advised clients in English and Turkish that the block could be worked around very easily by using SMS or short messaging system. In Kansas, Chelsea Manning applied for a legal name change. The Army private, formerly known as Bradley Edward Manning, was sentenced to 35 years after leaking photos, video, and documents implicating the U.S. military to WikiLeaks. Manning received a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, or gender identity disorder. In order for Manning to be able to live life as a woman, she must be discharged from the Army because the military doesn't acknowledge the disorder. Furthermore, the Pentagon won't let transgendered people serve. Civilian federal prisons are mandated to require counseling and hormone therapy to those suffering from gender dysphoria. The Portland Business Journal reported that 2 dozen money-making companies didn't pay any state income taxes again. After reviewing the Oregon Department of Revenue data, the Oregon Center for Public Policy says that 8 companies made over $5 million in profit and yet didn't pay taxes. The 2013 and 2015 budget cycle will have a loss of almost $165 million, up $35 million from the last period, because a tax break for multi-state corporations exists. The loophole, known as the single sales factor apportionment. Companies like Nike are lobbying the Governor Kitzhaber, to legislate to continue the loophole for the next 40 years as a gift before he leaves office. The Oregon Center for Public Policy, or OCPP, does in-depth research and analysis on budget, tax, and economic issues like income inequality levels and poverty levels. For more, go to www.ocpp.org. That's going to do it for the news at noon today. Please tune in every weekday at 5 p.m. for the latest in local, national, and international news brought to you by volunteers from our Southeast Portland studios.
Wow, that is so exciting. I hate to fade it down. You're listening to KBOO in Portland, and that was the David Grisman Quintet. And I'm Lori Sonnenfeld. This is Moving On. We come to you every Friday from noon to 1:30. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting an evening with Arlo Guthrie Wednesday, April 16th.